This is Mark Strassman, reporter with American Politics Today. We're about to speak to R. James Woolsey, former director of the CIA and now a crusader on the subject of oil and security. Welcome to Utopia Media's American Politics Today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
You've just written a paper called Oil and Security, and we're going to be talking about it.
Well, that's sort of like saying Daddy and I killed a bear. Former Secretary of State George Shultz and I wrote it together.
So. Okay. Former Treasury Secretary as well.
Yes, former Labor Secretary, former head of OMB, former lots of things.
Tell us what the main theme of that paper is.
Main theme is that because our transportation sector is so tied to oil and we can't make ready substitutions, and because our oil supply is vulnerable to terrorist interruption in the Middle East as well as regime change, because we give the Saudi regime a great deal of money that it funnels back to the Wahhabis, which underlies the ideology of the terrorists, very, very similar ideology, and because of global warming, for a whole number of reasons, we need to start moving rather decisively away from oil.
Well, one point you didn't make is made in a book called Out of Gas by Professor Goodstein at Caltech, which refers to the Hubert peak and talks about the eventual demise of the supply of oil, whatever the political and economic situation is.
That's true. Eventual, though, is the right word. And even if Saudi Arabia is moving toward a King Hubert peak for its fields, what that means is that its production costs will go up substantially, but its production costs are so small that we believe the Persian Gulf is going to really have a dominant share, maybe two-thirds or more, of the world's proven reserves for a long time. Saudi Arabia will have the swing of production, even if it's more expensive swing production than now. And so our fundamental strategic vulnerability is still, we think, going to be driven by that situation. Now, what the reaching the peaks of these fields means is that production costs everywhere will start to go up. It'll be different at different times for different fields.
So that's essentially going to, how is that going to change the situation? You're saying strategically
well,
it doesn't.
Another reason to begin to move from oil, because oil net around the world will be continuing to get more expensive, but the people who say, well, let the market deal with that, on long-term trends like that, we think they may have a point. But as far as terrorism is concerned, there's no other product that has the impact on our economy, the potential impact that oil could have if, for example, terrorists flew an airliner into the sulfur clearing towers up near Ras Tanura in northeastern Saudi Arabia. Bob Baer's new book begins with that scenario, and that could send take 6-7 million barrels a day offline for a year or more and send the world completely into an economic tailspin. So that's the sort of thing that could happen quickly.
How bad a tailspin would that be? How would that affect everyday life in the United States?
Well, with oil at $100 a barrel or more, which something like that could easily produce, just multiply by a factor of several what you're seeing with people concerned about $2.50 a gallon gasoline. It's money out of consumers' pockets. It's people having to cut down on a lot of what they do if they have long commutes and are locked into it because they've moved out into the suburbs. It's a huge impact on the cost of chemicals, many of which are made from oil, heating oil for the northeastern part of the country. Very few things suffuse our economy the way oil does, and particularly the transportation sector.
No, what you just said would be the effect of $100 a barrel. Oil is up to $62 a barrel today already, without any cataclysmic events.
There's no one tipping point.
Right.
I rather imagine that it would go well over $100 a barrel if those clearing towers were taken out.
Roughly, what would that translate into in terms of a gallon per cost per gallon of gas? $100, $150 a gallon.
Well, I think you're headed up toward $4 a gallon and more. Now, people will say, you know, the Europeans get by on that now because they have much more taxes on gasoline and diesel fuel than we do. But on the other hand, their fleet averages 42 miles a gallon, and ours has lost ground in the last few years. It now averages 24 miles a gallon. It was 26 miles a gallon back in the mid-'80s. So Europeans use an awful lot less per capita fuel for transportation than we do. And the Japanese use less still. They average about 47 miles a gallon.
Why is that?
It's because we have put more than 100% of the improvements in technology in the last 20 years into added horsepower and added weight, and our average fuel economy for the fleet has declined as more and more people have bought SUVs and larger cars and faster, higher horsepower cars. One of the interesting things about hybrids is that for comparable models a company like Toyota or Honda or Ford that would have exactly the same model in a hybrid and a standard internal combustion engine, the hybrid is not only 30, 40, 50% better in terms of fuel economy, it has higher horsepower. So people can have improved horsepower if they want. They can drive SUVs, but if the SUVs are hybrids, they'll be getting something like 30 miles a gallon instead of 15 to 20, and that's an improvement too.
Okay, if it were up to you, if you could combine the powers of all three branches of the government and the media, and make all of the economic decisions for everybody in the country, what scenario would you roll out that would resolve this issue?
Well, on that hypothetical,
right.
The simplest way to do this is a tax. On petroleum or on carbon, maybe as well, and let the market sort it out. But that sort of tax is the third rail of American politics, and we've had a number of people like Al Ullman in Oregon years ago who would propose it and get immediately defeated. So the economically most pure approach really isn't going to work.
And in fact, that would be sort of with a certain amount of government intervention, that would allow free market forces to work within the context of a government commitment to reducing oil consumption.
Yes, I think that's right. So I think the next best thing under the real world that we're living in is to propose that the government incentivize things that are either here or nearly here in terms of coming on the market, such as hybrids, and also fuels that are alternatives that can be used in the existing infrastructure, not like hydrogen that's going to take 10, 20 years to be available really commercially, but to use things like ethanol made from grasses, like prairie grasses, or biodiesel made from animal waste and the like, so that the feedstocks that you're using are very cheap and very widely distributed. Those principles seem to me to be the types of things to encourage and not picking individual technology.
Okay, I had a long interview about a week and a half ago with a professor of environmental engineering at Stanford to talk about wind power.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we're going to talk about wind power in a minute, but one of the upshots of that conversation was that biofuels such as ethanol or biodiesel take more energy to make than they yield. What do you say about that point?
Wind power, I love renewables. I got solar plant panels and solar hot water on my farmhouse roof. But 98% of our electricity is made from fuels other than oil. So back in the 1970s, when we made 20% of our electricity from oil, you could add wind power, and it would do something effective a bit in terms of reducing oil use. Today, you could have windmills on every hilltop, or for that matter, nuclear reactors, and it would have virtually no effect on our use of oil because we don't basically use oil anymore to produce electricity. That's what's wrong with all of the debate and proposals, whether it's from nuclear power advocates or renewables advocates, about changing the way we do electricity as a solution to the oil problem.
Okay.
Now, yep. Long term, if we move towards so-called plug-in hybrids, which is, I think, the next generation of hybrids, where you can plug in overnight in your garage, top off the battery, and drive for some period of time on grid power before you get to the hybrid feature, at that point, the electricity market starts again to be relevant to transportation, and it would be important to try to produce electricity as cleanly and effectively as possible, and that would have an effect on the oil debate. Today, the electricity debate basically is about what fuel to use, and it's about global warming, not about oil reduction.
So are you saying then if electricity can become a source of transportation power,
yes.
then that would have beneficial effects both on the electricity and the petroleum markets.
Absolutely. When you start with plug-in hybrids, and the website for people to look at on this is calcars.org, www.calcars.org. If you start with plug-in hybrids, you're going to be plugging them at night, and that is off-peak power, so basically you don't need additions at first to the electricity grid in order to do that. Utilities love to sell you off-peak power at night because...
It's found money for them and found right. power for you.
And there are indeed a number of utilities led by the Austin company the citizens of the city of Austin, Texas, owns its own utility, and a number of city-owned utilities around the country, they are going to the big three in Detroit and saying, if you'll build plug-in hybrids, we'll give people $1,000 credit on their electricity bill for the car when they purchase the car.
Well, what's Detroit said about that?
Well, I think hybrids, generally, Ford is the only one of the big three that seems to be moving that way. General Motors and, well, Daimler Chrysler is going to have some demonstration vans, but Ford seems to have begun to get the idea a bit. Of course, Toyota is really leading on hybrids. Toyota so far has not gone into the notion of plug-in hybrids. That's largely something that is being done privately in the U.S., but I think Toyota will be pushed to it within a year or two.
Does that mean that Detroit could, if it took a creative leap, could take a leap over Toyota by moving immediately to plug-in hybrids?
I think it could if it raise the money. It has, of course, huge problems with respect to retiree medical costs and the like, but they have to do something bold or they are going to lose the market to the Japanese and, before too many years, the Chinese producing fuel-efficient vehicles. Get out of their heads that they can keep making money by building gas guzzlers.
Is it a cultural issue or what?
I'm not sure. To some extent, I believe it is. And I think the oil crisis here, the post-9/11 world, has caught Detroit somewhat by surprise. Ford does have the Escape and is advertising it very highly, the hybrid SUV, and is apparently selling it well.
Could a Manhattan Project type project that would work on even better batteries be useful in this regard?
It doesn't need to be nearly as big a deal as a Manhattan Project. It needs to be battery work, and what you really want to do, I think, is move toward lithium batteries, but design them in a somewhat different way so that they don't burn at a very hot temperature if there's an accident and that sort of thing. But lithium-ion batteries are maybe 10 times the power of the nickel metal hydride that we use today in hybrids. If people follow that Calcar's website I described, they'll see the discussion of the relative advantages of different kinds of batteries. However you do it, you do need some battery improvements, and that is extremely important, electricity storage, for two reasons. One is the hybrids, but also the renewables that at least I love so much, and your professor at Stanford who's into wind, renewables are great, but they are intermittent, and so the heart of being able to use renewables more effectively is also electricity.
So beyond the transportation sector, having better batteries would allow for the accumulation of renewably generated electricity for businesses or residences,
yeah,
wouldn't
it? You're still going to need basic load electricity from gasified and hopefully carbonless coal that has had carbon sequestered from it, or from nuclear, or from something. But you can rely more on renewables if your storage of renewable generated electricity is better, and you can rely more on the grid to supply the electricity for plug-in hybrids if the batteries of the hybrids are also better. So batteries, George Shultz wanted to call our piece, "It's the Batteries, Stupid." And that's, there's a lot of rationale in that focus.
So in fact, that would mean people could locally store in their batteries power generated overnight, not just in their cars, but for their residential use.
The better your batteries are for photovoltaics or wind, the longer and the more effectively you can store. As I said, I think you'll still need basic load power from coal or nuclear or something like that, but you might need less of it If you're, particularly if your environment is, you know, for photovoltaics very sunny, or for wind, it's steady winds blowing at a right speed and so forth.
As a strategic thinker, are you, and as a person, are you upset or worried or concerned about the prospect that Toyota and, as you've said, the Chinese will be providing the plug-in hybrid technology that Detroit seems unable to produce fast enough?
Well, I'm also a former chairman of the board of Freedom House, which is the country's oldest human rights organization that promotes democracy and rule of law around the world.
Right.
And I'm much less concerned about the Japanese stealing a march on us than I am with the dictatorships, whether they're communist or fascist. I think we can work closely with the Chinese and a lot of other people on improving our use of renewables and fuel efficiency and all the rest. But whether it's in this area or any other, I feel much less concern about Japanese companies, which will play by the rule of law and are actually, you know, part of a democratic society. I'd feel much less concern about their playing a major role in our economy than I do about a dictatorship.
Well, that right. Characterizing the Chinese as a dictatorship and being concerned about the role they play, they seem to be buying the bulk of U.S. Treasury bonds, and they keep every day low prices at Walmart, low every day.
We are codependent. They need us to buy what they're producing, and we need them to hold our treasuries as we borrow about $2 billion a day from the rest of the world to finance our consumption, and we borrow about $1 billion of that a day, every working day, about $250 billion a year, from the world to finance our oil imports.
Is that sustainable?
I don't think so. I think it's going to damage the dollar and run the risk of sharp interest rate increases and damage to the economy. Every billion dollars of that $250 billion that we pay for imported oil that we'll pay this year, every billion of that we can use to produce, let's say, ethanol from prairie grasses or biodiesel, renewable diesel from animal waste in this country, it's probably about 10,000 to 20,000 American jobs. So a part of all this is being able to resuscitate some of the economies of rural America and, frankly, rural parts of the rest of the world. It'd be a great thing for Bangladesh, for Bangladeshi farmers to be able to use animal waste and rice straw from their rice paddies and so forth to have local production of transportation fuel so they don't have to spend, their country doesn't have to spend $60 a barrel to import oil from Saudi Arabia.
Okay. Now, I don't want to blame 280 million Americans for this problem, but I'm wondering to what extent that the population's reluctance or failure to discipline its consumption habits and how it finances them, it can be modified in time to avert what seems, from what you're saying, to be an inevitable collision between profligate consumption in an undisciplined way and some kind of eco-political commercial disaster.
Well, the gasoline prices are helping move people toward things like hybrids, and I think probably this fall toward some of the newer versions of diesels that have very good fuel efficiency and are a lot cleaner than diesels used to be, and I think will help move them toward some of these types of fuels I've been describing as well. But it would help a lot if the president would move beyond what he's done. And he didn't touch on this issue much for years. And then about 3 months ago, he went down to a biodiesel facility in Virginia and made a very good speech about the importance of hybrids and diesels and biodiesel.
I did a big story lauding him for doing that.
Yeah, and he's said several positive things recently. And this energy bill is not, from my point of view, very good, but it's better than it would have been if there hadn't been at least some efforts along these lines. I give it about a C minus, maybe, but at least it's not absolutely flunking. And I think that if he would take that further and call upon people in light of the war on terrorism, in light of our oil dependence on the Middle East, this very volatile part of the world, call on people to undertake every possible effort to save on oil. You know, Franklin Roosevelt knew exactly what he was doing in World War II when he asked everybody to plant a victory garden. Part of it was the garden that helped produce food, but it also made everybody feel involved in what was going on. People want to be asked to do something other than shop, and all we've been asked to do so far really is shop.
Could we talk about the Bush-Saudi connection? The last time, one of the last pictures I saw of the president, he was literally holding hands with the new king of Saudi Arabia.
What?
And there's so much to talk about there, but why don't we just talk about the fact that the Bush history is replete with connections to the Saudi royal family.
A little sympathy with him on the hand-holding, because when I was director of Central Intelligence, I had to visit that part of the world, and that's a custom in the Arab world. Often a man will grab your hand, and you think, what in the world here? But, that didn't bother me. And I must say, I think this has been a common problem for Republican and Democratic administrations. I've served in two Republican and two Democratic administrations, and I don't see a huge difference over the course of the last 20, 30 years. We've missed opportunities in the Carter and Clinton administrations just as we've missed them in the Reagan and both Bush administrations for moving away from oil and oil dependence.
Are you saying that as long as the country is dependent on oil, the country is going to need to be cooperative with the Saudi royal family?
Well, there is an incentive to do that. I'll give you one example that just appalls me. A few years ago, when the Crown Prince was flying to Texas, I think his pilot decided that he didn't want to talk to the female air traffic controller that he was talking to flying over the United States, and he objected, and the FAA changed the air traffic controller. Now, I don't think there's any remote chance that that was an order from on high. That's just the way people have reacted to even outrageous requests like that from the Saudis. If we can turn the corner on oil dependence and begin to see a lot more hybrids and very good diesels and beginnings of plug-in hybrids and alternative fuels that are cheap and made from cheap feedstocks, we start to see all these things developing at once, it will really get the Saudis' attention. They will, I think, start to be less insistent on talking only to male air traffic controllers and the other sorts of things.
I read a column by Paul Krugman in the New York Times this morning in which he said that ExxonMobil is responsible for convincing people there is no such thing as global warming. The oil companies themselves, which of course themselves have even cozier relationships with the governments in the Middle East than the U.S. government does, is an important decision maker in this whole process.
Well,
is their power enough to overcome the goodwill and suggestions that you're making?
I haven't followed Exxon's statements on this very closely, but I have watched what BP and Shell have said.
Yes.
BP talks now about being beyond petroleum. Shell.
I passed a sign from ARCO a few minutes ago that said we're thinking beyond the next tank.
Well, that's good.
Well, it's clear that their public relations machines
Step. Shell is actually putting some money behind a Canadian company called Iogen that is the first on the market with ethanol made from grass.
Right.
It's on the market now in Canada, and it's financed in part by Shell. So, this is not a monolithic thing.
What we
want to do is encourage all the oil companies to start thinking of themselves as energy companies and to move, I think, help the country and help Detroit to move to fuel-efficient vehicles and toward alternative fuels.
Well,
there's no reason
that
the companies that are now oil companies shouldn't be involved in producing these alternative fuels.
Well, it may be the case for fuels, but we remember what Ted Levitt said about trains going out of business because they didn't realize they were in the transportation business.
Right.
But in terms of the possibility of a decentralized renewable energy system,
mm-hmm.
where local wind, local solar provides a significant portion of energy, wouldn't that take the big oil companies, even if they became the big ethanol companies, more out of the loop than they would like to, and therefore they don't see any incentive to try to convert the energy system from a centralized to a decentralized one?
There's plenty of time for any investment that anybody's got in oil refineries and the rest of that to amortize, even if we moved at a breakneck pace toward alternative fuels, toward relying more on a hopefully much more decentralized electricity grid with things like plug-in hybrids. There's plenty of technology and opportunities and need for skilled engineers and so forth in this energy world. All it takes is a spirit of being willing to think about change.
It seems to me that in a you strike me as a very rational thinker, and the suggestions you're making are all very rational. But I'm wondering whether they take into sufficient account the vested interests of people who like things the way they are and benefit from. In particular, you were dependent on. You suggested it would be good if the president would take the lead on this. And apart from the culturally relative aspect of holding hands with the royal family, is the commercial and political fact of the president's career as a quote oil man and the relationship of his father and the Saudis in and out of government, and the fact that his political existence depends to a large extent on the support of the interests that you're saying could find a way to ease themselves out of the picture, but they don't seem to be showing any intention of doing that.
I may be politically naive about this, but I think...
I don't want to be in a position of calling the former director of Central Intelligence politically naive.
Well, politics is not my long suit.
Okay.
But I think that public servants, whether they're in the Congress or in the White House, generally are trying to do what's best for the country. I think what we have in the case of some of the oil business, or when I was growing up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, we used to call it the oil business, people coming from that background, is a matter of customary thinking. It's not so much a matter of personal current economic interest.
Okay, let's call it customary thinking.
Yeah.
How can the president's customary thinking be changed?
Well, I think it's begun to change. I think that speech you praised about 3 months ago was an important step for this administration. And I think they're proposing credits at which passed the Congress for diesels and hybrids. I wish he would move beyond corn-based ethanol and soybean-based biodiesel and think much more broadly about the feedstocks that are going to be available, a lot cheaper than those two feedstocks. But he's at least started to head in the direction of encouraging alternative fuels and fuel efficiency, and has done it several times since that speech down in Virginia. I think there's been progress in the White House.
Okay, could you compare what seemed to be your dire predictions about the future based on dependence on oil and your mild-mannered suggestions that a little bit more mindset changing at the higher levels of the government will be enough to bring about the rather drastic or radical changes that I think you're saying are essential?
Well, I don't know how best to encourage congressional leadership and the White House to move out smartly on this. I think some parts of Congress have started to push it more than the White House has, but the White House has begun to push it. And we do need some decisive efforts on alternative fuels and fuel-efficient vehicles. This new bill has encouraged them some, not nearly enough from my point of view, but at least some of the provisions of it are better than they would have been, I think, 6 months or a year ago. This country's politics, and particularly on an issue related to the biggest business in the world, oil, are sort of like that of an aircraft carrier. You can turn the helm on take the helm and turn it on the aircraft carrier, and it takes quite a while for the thing to come around.
How close? That was the problem the Titanic had. How close to being at a point of no return on that collision course with reality do you think we are, and how long do you think we have to get someone in the helm or have the action by the people below decks to change course?
What we have to do is use the time that we've gained. I think we have gained some time, particularly by the war in Afghanistan, by disrupting Al-Qaeda and the like. It's still around. It's still going to be trying to undertake terrorist attacks, but I think it's weakened compared to where it was on 9/11. And what we have to do is get people to understand that on things like moving away from such heavy oil dependence, they, if they're lucky, they're going to have a few years, and maybe you know, our efforts overseas, the glimmerings of democracy in Lebanon, the move in Egypt to have at least something approximating a real election. Some of these steps, as well as you know, if we're very lucky, a good outcome of this Constitutional Convention, August 15th in Iraq. These things all help weaken Al-Qaeda, and they help weaken the terrorist movement around the world. And we have to put all this together. We have to take what the GIs and Marines and British Tommies are doing in Iraq and hope that that's going to help buy us some time to make these changes here, and we don't just sort of sit here on our hands while they're over there getting killed.
Well, isn't that the problem? That people, the war is largely invisible, except in places where the people's children are dying.
Right.
And I'm wondering whether the structure of American society now exists in a way that it's out of sight, it's out of mind, and people are willing, on some level, to let other people die for them, but they're not willing to change their driving habits.
Americans, I think, will change a lot of things if they're called upon to do so. And this is the step the president has not really taken yet. He's moved some important distance beyond where he was, I think, last winter. But he really needs to rally the country to move away from oil on an urgent basis.
Do you think that he
could? I agree. He has not done that yet. But I think once people are called upon to do these things, a lot of people will respond. One of the reasons is because there are a number of rationales that people have for doing the same thing. Mine has largely proceeded from a national security concern, but I'm also an environmentalist, and I'm worried about global warming, and there are people I know who aren't worried about security at all, but they're really worried about global warming. Well, you know, we can make common cause. It doesn't matter how much what percentage of one's views are influenced by one of these rationales versus another. So I think there are a lot of people, in for one reason or another, who are willing to move toward moving away from oil, but they need to be called upon to do it and told that it's a matter of great urgency and we've got to get going.
Okay, two final questions here, focusing on the presidency. I don't know whether you were involved in the decision where Richard Nixon, renowned anti-communist, went to China.
I was practicing law at the time.
Okay. But it seems to me that your hope that President Bush will declare the need to remove the United States from oil dependency would have been like Richard Nixon declaring that he was a member of the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China.
It's not quite that big a leap, but it is somewhat like Nixon going to China anyway. I agree with that.
Okay. And so I guess, unlike Saudi Arabia, heads of government are not set up for life in the United States. Do you see any movements or individuals on the horizon who have a plausible chance of becoming president in 2008 who might steer the U.S. in the course that you've suggested that the president ought to?
Well, the man I backed in 2000 as an old Scoop Jackson Democrat was John McCain. And he's recently ginned up his pack, and I don't know. I haven't talked to him recently. I don't know whether he's running or not, and he might have a real struggle inside the Republican Party. But
he's a Scoop Jackson.
He's been wonderful, at least from my point of view, on these energy issues. He working with Senator Joe Lieberman on the global warming issues and on fuel conservation and all the rest. I think he and Lieberman have been just terrific on these.
Okay, so we might see you as an advisor and Secretary of State or something in the McCain administration?
I'm a Democrat and just kind of sitting out here on the sidelines.
Well, he's a Republican, and John Kerry considered, I think, offered him the spot as his vice president. So
He's a remarkable individual. I've known him for 25 years.
All right. Can you help me get an interview with him to talk about this?
Well, send me the material via email, and I'll forward it in. I don't know that it'll get through the
expensive perimeter.
Billions of communications that John McCain's office receives every day, I'm sure, but I'll send it in.
Okay, and I want to thank you for talking to us today about the need for lessening the United States' dependence on foreign oil.
Sure, delighted to be with you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.